This week on Your Western Context, we celebrate Canada Day when the media doesn't. BC Premier John Horgan is retiring, and Alberta posts a $3.9 billion surplus. Also, a new online tax in BC could make businesses uncompetitive. This is Western Context, episode 276, recorded Saturday, July 2nd, 2022. New leaders in taxes. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back, as we are each and every week. And, of course, we're rounding out the Canada Day weekend, so happy Canada Day. In passing, of course, to our listeners, one of our stories is about that. But we also do have a good amount of other stories to discuss, too.
Yes, of course, it's been a very busy week in BC, of course, what with many news stories that we're going to talk about this week, and certainly there's going on around the rest of the country as well, and we welcome everybody around the world who listens to us and those in Canada. We hope you had a very happy Canada Day and celebrate it in the way that you wish to. And to our American listeners, of course, in a couple of days they'll be celebrating July 4th. So happy Independence Day to them as well. And we're here at the beginning of July to break down the news of the week that has happened in Canada and why it matters to you.
If you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is the podcast that aims to cut through all the media bias and sensationalism that you find, whether it's on TV, in the newspapers, online. And as we must know, there is a lot of news online that has bias and sensationalism in it. And that's not always healthy. And that's why we aim to remove all that. And in removing that, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary for you to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And if you want to follow along with us, we have our full show notes, which you can find at westerncontext.ca. And we're going to start off this week with a story about Canada Day. And in particular, if you've been following some of the media coverage around the country, you'll see that even though it's Canada Day, there has been some questions about what the Canadian flag means this year that might be different than previous years. And of course, we're coming to you on the weekend after Canada Day has concluded, of course, and this has been perhaps the most normal Canada Day that people have celebrated since 2019. And people across the country have been waiting and hoping for things to return to normal, as they mostly have this year. Now, the question that's come up for some, including the Prime Minister, is whether or not Canada Day should be divisive and what our flag should mean. And there's been a huge amount of discussion since the convoy protests in January and February about whether or not the flag has had its national symbolism diminished because of the groups that have used it as their emblem. But, of course, what we're going to be remembering through this story is that the Canadian flag is for all Canadians. Now, in his Canada Day statement, Justin Trudeau said, "Today, we celebrate the place we all call home. I know for some, our country's historic wrongs can make that difficult. But while we can't change history, we can put in the work to build a better future, one that reflects our values of hope, resilience, kindness, respect, and generosity." He then continued saying that today is an opportunity for all of us to recommit ourselves to those values, values that the maple leaf represents, because our flag is more than a symbol, it's also a promise of opportunity, a promise of safety for those fleeing violence and war, and a promise of a better life. And pair these statements back, and that is a fine interpretation of what the Canadian flag can mean, but it's also, of course, a representation of everything that makes Canada our country. Now, numerous media outlets, including some such as the Ottawa Citizen, CBC, and the Toronto Star, all featured articles and columnists over the past few days talking about the debate, or the so-called tug of war, that's been going on around the flag. Now, what these columnists failed to realize is that those involved in the protests earlier this year were using the flag as their symbol because what they were protesting for was their own vision of a better life and their commitment to Canadian values. And if you ask any Canadian, of course, you'll find that what makes someone Canadian is a different perspective depending on who you ask and where you ask that in the country. And the same thing can be said for the Canadian values. Of course, what the Prime Minister orchestrated is one option, but there's many other options out there depending on your own upbringing and where you're from in the country. Now, going to the Ottawa Citizen piece, which you can find in our supplementals linked at westerncontext.ca, this piece talks about how the Canadian flag, for some, represents a symbol of patriotism, like those seen in the January 6th, 2021 riots at the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. Now, this is an interesting angle and take, because the Canadian flag always represents Canadian patriotism. It's just that Canadians don't display it as often as our friends to the south do. And over the last number of years, there have been various national events and various national anniversaries where that display of Canadian patriotism has come out more than it has in recent years, and there's nothing wrong with that, and many say that that feeling of Canadian patriotism was always there. It just wasn't always expressed by Canadians. Now, for many, because of the protests we saw back in January and February, they say that the flag has caused it to become a symbol that causes unsettling feelings. And if we look at the Ottawa Citizen piece, we're left with a mishmash of words describing that feeling, and it says that the sight of Canada's flag for many is accompanied by the sickly feeling that comes with the knowledge that the core beliefs we've always recognized as inherently Canadian are not so universal, and that the beliefs many are noisily defending and the loyalty professed by these groups are not what Pearson, of course the Prime Minister who brought our current flag in, hoped that the new flag would inspire. Now, this is one long run-on sentence, as you can tell by the various shifts in tone and the various angles that it was taking, and a run-on sentence that needs to be read 2 to 3 times before understanding what the author is going for isn't necessarily going to be the best way to make a point. Typically, the best and most resonated points are made quickly and in a few words. The word salad approach, as it has been called, tells us that what the author saw earlier this year broke their vision of what Canada is, and there's still a way that they're not able to describe that in terms of something that's reconcilable with modern-day reality. Put simply, we live in a society where people are increasingly becoming siloed and the views of the other side can often seem alien. Now, if you strip back what was said, even with the Prime Minister's statement this year, the universal goal is that the Canadian flag represents us as a country, and it also represents our values. The question of debate around the flag is not new, and it's been a question that always comes up for when people ask what Canada stands for. Now, for media outlets to act like it's a new effect and amplify stories of the flag, as some say, hurting their heart, only amplifies the problems of division that we've seen so many times recently in this country. At the end of the day, the country is divided because of a government of 7 years pushing people and regions against one another, while the media amplified these divisions for their own uses when it comes to pushing stories, when it comes to garnering views, clicks, and likes, and that's part of the big reason that Western Context is here. At the same time, though, with Canada Day now mostly behind us, we need to remember that we all share the same flag, and people on both sides have greatly taken for granted what we have here in this country. And we saw that numerous times in stories that we've talked about here at Western Context, whether it be the case for the people who sometimes would align themselves with the NDP or saying that we need to, in effect, reform the country to become more progressive. Or on the absolute other side, after the 2019 election, we saw the huge outpouring of Wexit Alberta support. All of these things are dancing around the same issue, but are inherently trying to solve the problem in a way that is different than what's needed. And instead, people on both sides should be cheerful and grateful for what we have in this country instead of honing in on the divisions of the past on both sides. And the interesting part about this is that there was very few media stories and media outlets that did this when talking about Canada Day this year, when that should have been the key thing that the media and people across the country should have taken home from this year's Canada Day, with it being one of the first normal ones since 2019, is that instead of amplifying divisions, it should have been an opportunity to try and heal and move past those.
Yeah, and I think that when it comes down to it, Canada Day and its meaning to a lot of Canadians has changed over the past few years. And it always seems that the ones that get the most airtime are the ones that have the most radical views on the Canadian flag. Either the view that it's being worn by many people that participated in the Freedom Convoy protests, or that it's a flag that symbolizes a colonial country that has a very dark past, and that is not something to be proud of. And there is a middle ground, of course, is that yes, there have been problems in history, but there's also problems with any country's history. And we have to look at it in the context of today and not apply historical problems to something that's going on today. Because there's many issues that are happening today that can be fixed and addressed. And I think that that's something worth talking about, of course. And it's always good to reflect on that on Canada Day and thinking of what Canada really is. But at the end of the day, Canada is a great place to live. There are many things to be to express gratitude for that we have in Canada that many countries are not even close to getting. And many people in those countries would love to have the chance to come to Canada. And many do, as many immigrants come into Canada year after year. And, most places in the country have the freedom to have clean water. A lot of places have great economic and civil liberties. A lot of places across the globe do not have those things. So there is a lot to be proud of for in Canada, and there's a lot that our country is that that has been made great. And there's still a lot that can be done to make it even better. We're not in a place where we can rest on our laurels and say, yes, we've now completed the country building, and we want to just keep everything the same, because I think there are things that can always be improved, but we have to make the right steps to do that.
And that work will only, of course, be done once everybody is happy. And in a country of 37, 38 million people, that's never going to happen. So there's always going to be something to strive for and something to push for around the next corner. And this is why, since the beginning of Western Context, we've been a huge proponent that whoever is in government at various levels, whether it be nationally or in any of the provinces, needs to strike a tone of unity and working together and not necessarily dividing people. Because as we mentioned, that, combined with what we see in the media, is one of the reasons this entire podcast exists and has existed. And if you want to help us with that goal in terms of bringing Western Context forward, you can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/Western Context, where you can support the podcast monetarily if you so choose to, starting for as little as $2 a month. You can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month at the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. And of course, with everything becoming more expensive in this country, we're not going to, of course, re-index our prices to inflation and make them even higher for that. These are going to be the prices that you see. They're not going to go up at any point in the future, as far as we know, unless something absolutely major were to happen, of course. And that's one of the things why we like using Patreon as a way of allowing you, our listeners, to support the podcast. And you're probably wondering, well, what do we get out of that? When we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article. And at $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we'll reflect on the news stories of the month in a candid way. And we also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. And of course, this week is also a pretty heavy news week in BC as well. We have two BC stories this week, and we learned that this week BC Premier John Horgan will be stepping down, and that's BC story number one.
Yes, after 5 years in the role, John Horgan announced on Tuesday that he plans to step down as the Premier of British Columbia, and he has asked his governing party, the NDP, to hold a leadership convention later this year. Now, he was been in Vancouver attending a cabinet retreat with the governing part of his party, and he said that he wanted to address the speculation surrounding his future as premier, especially after his recent bout with cancer and the controversial project involving the Royal BC Museum in downtown Victoria that the ECNDP decided to walk back their plans on after a huge amount of public outcry. Now, Horgan said that while he is cancer-free now and that his health is good, his energy flags as the days go by, and recent conversations with his family also had him reflect on what he wanted to do. And he said, quote, "I wish I had the energy to do more, but I don't. I get tired and I come home and I fall asleep," which is probably relatable to many people these days. Now, Horgan acknowledges that while there has been endless speculation as a result of his recent bout with cancer and what his plans would be, he said he wanted to put the speculation to rest so that we can get back to what really matters, and that's the issues before British Columbians. Now, he said he'll remain as premier for the time being and said that he has asked the president of the BCNDP to work with the party's governing body to select a date in the fall for a leadership convention, and when we find out when exactly that leadership convention will be, we'll know more about who is going to be running in that. Now, as chair of the Council of the Federation, which is a body made up of the premiers from Canada's 13 provinces and territories, Horgan said that he still plans to hold the federal government to account on resolving the country's public health crisis, namely the Canada Health Transfer that is provided to provinces and territories for health care. Now, the next meeting of the council is set in about a week's time in Victoria. And Horgan said during Tuesday's news conference that, quote, "The Prime Minister committed to me that his team would be there to have that conversation and to make progress, and I'm going to hold him to that." Now, Horgan, who's 62, has served as Premier of BC since 2017 and became leader of the BCNDP back in 2014. Now, in November, he announced that he would start radiation treatment after cancerous growth was found in his throat, and the Premier had previously undergone successful treatment for bladder cancer back in his 40s. Now, in January, Horgan said that he had completed his cancer treatment after going through 35 rounds of radiation. Now, back in May, Horgan has said that he would not rule out a third term in office, even though his tenure has not been without its challenges. Of course, last week, Horgan announced that the province would go back to the drawing board after the public outcry involving the Royal BC Museum. The province had previously, of course, released thousands of pages of documents supporting its decision to replace the museum for approximately $800 million. But of course, that decision at that time, in this particular political climate and economic realities for many people, it was seen that $800 million could be spent much better on other projects that are needing more fuller attention. Now, of course, when Horgan does indeed step down, we'll do a retrospective on his tenure as BC Premier and a critical look at whether his policies and governments have bettered BC and its people. Now, of course, the speculation turns to who will lead the BCNDP and therefore the province after Horgan does step down. Now, names of almost a dozen potential successors to Horgan are being bandied about, including Attorney General David Eby, Jobs Minister Ravi Kalon, Municipal Affairs Minister Nathan Cullen, Infrastructure Minister Bowen Ma and Finance Minister Selena Robinson. Now, David Black, an associate professor in communication and culture at Royal Roads University, says that the next leader will need to engage both urban and rural voters like Horgan and previous BC Liberal premiers Gordon Campbell and Christy Clark had done. Now, when, of course, we get more information on when the convention will be held, or to whoever decides to throw their hat into the ring, we'll be here to provide full coverage on the potential new leader of the province.
And this is exactly, well, it's not exactly the same, but it's a similar situation to what we have going on in Alberta. You have the two most western provinces of the country. As we head into the fall, they're going to be getting new premiers. And these new people are going to become premier instantly. They're not going to have to face the people in the case of Alberta for another 6 to 8 months. And in BC, it's going to be a while longer if the leader so wills it. And the interesting part about all that is that these represent the opportunities for substantial cases of change, which is what the grassroots asked for in Alberta. But that's probably not what the BC NDP grassroots have been asking for in BC, because if we look at the comparison between the two provinces, there was a consistent discussion about the future of Jason Kenney since the start of the pandemic. But if you look at most of the media coverage and most of what's going on grassroots level at the BC NDP level, where that exists, there really hasn't been too much criticism of John Horgan, either in BC or across the country on that. So it's going to raise the question, does the BC NDP become complacent and choose somebody who's a little bit more activist from the activist NDP side? Or do they choose someone who is more similar to John Horgan and governs from the center, as he has done to the shock of many, and that's one of the big questions that always comes up when the NDP government is, do they govern from the left, as Rachel Notley did and Jagmeet Singh would do, or are they going to govern from the center, like John Horgan has done?
Yeah, it's interesting to see how the years that Horgan has been as premier has kind of moderated a lot of the more radical edges of the NDP and has kept most of the more radical or, you know, further to the left people out of his cabinet. And I think that they've been looking more along the lines of policies that would help British Columbians rather than trying to be more ideological with their policies and trying to push an agenda. And I think that that's something that a lot of British Columbians have picked up on and kind of added to his popularity, especially in his more early years. Of course, it's, as I said, not without its controversies, calling an early election last year that many people didn't think were needed, or in 2020, rather. And I think that, the recent problems with health in the province, especially over the past couple of years, but also with the overdose crisis that has still been ongoing. There's challenges in BC still that have not been resolved by the government, and I think that there's a case to be made that he could have done more. But at this point, it's clear that many people are worried as to who will replace Horgan and whether it will turn the NDP more to the left again, or if the problems of the province that need to be addressed are going to get as much attention as they did under John Horgan. And I think that's a question that many will have going forward. And as he retires and looks after himself going to the future, we'll have to have a look and see how the province is going to shape up out of it.
Yeah, and it's going to be very important, of course, as BC is a significant economic engine to the country, and whether or not the incoming premier decides to carry on the same path, that could have ramifications for the entire country as well. So a lot of people tend to focus the provinces on their own affairs, but they do matter nationally, of course, and that's why we talk about it here at Western Context. And we have a lesson just like that out of Alberta in our Alberta story this week, where we got the final numbers for Alberta's 2021-22 fiscal year. And this fiscal year saw the province reap a $3.9 billion surplus, while initially they were scheduled to have about an $18 billion deficit. And this is, of course, due to the huge increase in the price of natural resources. And you'll remember a couple months ago, we talked about the story that the budget for 2022-23 is forecasting a surplus to be under about $500 million. But with this surplus, we're going to see that this is going to be much, much higher going forward one more year. And the interesting part about all of this is that that budget that forecast that deficit was made with oil prices hovering at about $46 a barrel, but instead they came out at $77 a barrel, whereas on Friday before markets closed, oil prices were sitting at about $108 a barrel. So if this trend continues through the winter and into next year, Alberta is going to have an even bigger surplus next year, and all options are on the table about what could be done with it. Now, with this, the Alberta Heritage Savings Trust Fund has been expanded to $20 billion, and the fund is an investment savings fund which produces income to support programs in the province. The provincial debt has also been paid down by $1.3 billion. Debt payments have been reduced by $123 million, and there's a ton of options going forward, as I mentioned, about what might just be around the corner with some of the revenue and money that the province is going to be seeing. Now, it's also important to note that this 2021-22 budget came in over on its expenditure side, and even with that, when the province spent more than $2.5 billion more than they were intending, they still wound up with a $3.9 billion surplus. And because of this, the province is being very cautious in that the fortunes for the province could reverse as quickly as they turn positive. Finance Minister Jason Nixon said that the government is dedicating itself to not being on the roller coaster and instead to be more strategic with these large windfalls and resource revenues that come in. Now, the province also gained $2 billion, more than half of the surplus, by partially reversing previously expected losses around the Sturgeon refinery. And this Sturgeon refinery has been a story since the Stelmach government, first when they were going to be working with carbon capture and storage and a push to refine more fuels in the province. And there was also a good deal of controversy when Energy Minister Sonia Savage made decisions to reverse the refinery agreements because the government viewed the contracts as too restrictive. In particular, the province wanted the ability to renegotiate financing and have a say in the operations and cost controls around the refinery, and because they did that, they were able to gain this extra $2 billion. The Alberta government was previously paying 75% of all costs associated with the refinery, and making these changes brought those $2 billion forward. Now, this is an impressive opportunity here if the current financial trends continue into the next year and we continue to see surpluses. They could be well north of $10 billion for the next couple of years, and this offers the chance to do practically anything in the province on the finances side. There will be, of course, those who call for more spending, and there will be those who call for blanket cuts, as is the case in the province. But the province also has to be creative in terms of how it saves the money going forward and should consider using the surpluses as an opportunity to build a war chest to disconnect the province from the energy boom-bust cycle. Now, there's also nothing off the table with the UCP leadership contenders, where Rebecca Schultz is calling on the province to reindex income tax brackets to account for inflation and to let people keep more of their money. Travis Tays touted himself as the candidate responsible for this fiscal performance, as he's been finance minister since 2019 before starting his leadership campaign. And Brian Jean announced that royalties will not need to be paid on any barrel of oil that's refined in Alberta, which he estimates will lower gas prices at the pump by another 15 cents a liter. The province says, of course, that they still intend to strike a panel later this year to review revenue sources for the government to determine what should be done to ensure that we don't end up in a situation like we saw previously when energy prices were low. And barring the dark times of the past 2 years and the lack of extra pipelines and a federal government hostile to natural resource projects, the province would be booming. With these resource revenues, it's also entirely possible that an NDP-led government would have balanced the budget as well with their past fiscal projections. And it's not only the money side that's interesting. If we look at the May Statistics Canada jobs reports, it shows that 69% of all new jobs in Canada were created in Alberta, while we only represent 12% of the population. With this, unemployment and bankruptcies are down, housing and business starts are up, wages are up, and rig counts are up, and by all economic indicators, Alberta is doing quite well. And this comes to the interesting part, because this is exactly the mandate that Jason Kenney and the UCP promised in 2019, yet the actions taken by the UCP government were not enough for the grassroots to keep Jason Kenney on as leader. By all accounts, the government did what they said they were going to do, and politically and economically have the data to back up their decisions. Going forward, it's going to be important for the UCP leadership contenders to remember that this is the position we're in, and doing anything to stray from the mainstream of Albertans has the potential to be dangerous. The typical media establishment, and some even in Alberta, see this province as a conservative heartland to experiment with. But in reality, the cities of Edmonton and Calgary mean that any government in the province needs to take a moderate approach and not swing too far to the left and not swing too far to the right. This budgeting story also shares ramifications for other provinces and the federal government as well, showing how important it is to treat the economy as an engine based on psychology, infuse it with the right policies, and time those policies with global events to make the best out of our situation, no matter how precarious it might seem in the turbulent times that we've lived in.
Yes, as you said, there's definitely lots of comparisons that can be made between Alberta and BC. But at the end of the day here with Alberta, there's been a good fiscal year for 2021-22, and that the surplus that's going to be coming up is going to be better because of the oil prices, of course, but also I think a lot of other businesses coming back online after the past couple of years is probably helping it out quite a bit as well. And I think that when it comes down to it, Alberta has been able to finagle their finances in such a way that they can have this surplus so that there is a bit of wiggle room if another problem arises, or if oil prices go down, they've got a little bit of leeway to work with there. And I think that when people are wanting the government to spend that surplus on any number of things happening, you have to be careful, because you don't want to get further into debt again and run into problems where you have to pay a lot of money to service that debt. So I think at the end of the day, Jason Kenney and the UCP did make a lot of promises back in 2019, and well, they fulfilled quite a few of those promises, and they've changed a lot of it. But because of all the I think when it comes down to it, it's just the media focus on Jason Kenney, and that had a real negative impact on his numbers, and well, he felt that he needed to resign to preserve the status of the party. And we'll have to see what happens going forward with the UCP leadership contenders, and just like we will in BC with the NDP here. And I think that it's going to be interesting to see how the two most western provinces handle changing their leaders as we get towards the end of 2022.
Yeah, and it's going to be a huge important story to continue talking about and compare the differences and parallels between the two provinces, and look at exactly where Alberta is as we head into 2023, and realize that whoever becomes leader is going to be dealt a hand that is better than anyone thought that they could have at this point in time, coming out of a pandemic, coming out of recessions and sluggish economic growth periods, to the point where the sky is the limit, really, and the only limit is in terms of the imagination. of the candidates, and whether or not they decide to capitalize on that is one thing, or if they were to put up different restrictions instead, economic restrictions, which we hope they wouldn't do, but there's ramifications to that as well when you look at things such as the rising costs of everything due to inflation. We're going to look at one of those cases that's happening right now in BC.
Yes, and at a time when inflation is hitting hard, many governments in the Western world are rolling out policies that aim to make life more affordable for everyday people. Now, in Canada, not too many governments are following that trend, and the federal government, of course, is not playing ball, as we've said many times before, that their policies are specifically crafted to, one, keep gas prices high, and, of course, the debt spending that they're doing while relying on the housing market to keep GDP high has artificially propped up the economy up while the prices are surging, and there's not really much that can be done about that because, well, in contrast to Alberta, the Canadian government is not running the surpluses and they're not staying in within their means. Now in BC, instead of tax relief, we're actually getting another tax that just got added to this list, this time on goods bought through online marketplaces such as Amazon. Now, starting on July 1st, which was a couple days before you're hearing this, the BC government has made changes that require these online marketplaces that have annual gross revenues of more than $10,000 to collect the provincial sales tax on goods and services sold on their sites. Now, in doing so, it shifts the responsibility to companies like eBay and Amazon to collect the PST rather than the small businesses that may use the marketplace facilitator site to sell their products. Now, in addition, these marketplaces are also being required by the province to charge PST to individual sellers for use of their services, such as help with listing, the sale of goods, advertising, warehousing, and payment collection. Now, the BC government expects that the PST rule changes will generate an additional $100 million in revenue this fiscal year, as well as $120 million the following year. Now, the Retail Council of Canada says that the move to treat online marketplaces the same as brick-and-mortar stores does make sense because it puts businesses on an equal footing, but it also cautions that BC's businesses may become more uncompetitive as a result. Now, the addition of the PST for services purchased by sellers in BC, often small businesses, will simply add costs for consumers here and make local sellers uncompetitive, as other jurisdictions in Canada have not introduced the similar measure and probably won't in the near future. Now, Carl Littler, who is the Senior Vice President of Public Affairs for the Retail Council of Canada, said, quote, "It doesn't exist anywhere else. It's a new tax between a marketplace facilitator like an Amazon or Best Buy or Facebook and someone who's selling goods." Now, the council is concerned that small BC merchants will be paying the 7% PST on these online marketplace services, irrespective of whether the end customer is in BC or elsewhere. Now, this will make them less competitive versus other businesses operating in other North American jurisdictions. Now, in BC, people who buy goods and services through the online marketplaces will be charged the PST on top of the now higher-priced goods themselves, which is a form of double taxation, according to the Retail Council. As well, the changes serve as a disincentive to marketplace services to locate facilities and, therefore, jobs in BC as well. Now, Werner Antweiler, who is a professor at the Souder School of Business at the University of BC, said that having online marketplaces collect PST on goods and services closes a loophole in taxation and helps collect tax from sellers abroad. What's different about BC's approach is that the inclusion of the PST on online marketplace services provided to online marketplace sellers. Now, it may be that other provinces or the federal government will follow suit, but this new rule may disadvantage online facilitators from setting up in BC, as BC would be hard-pressed to enforce tax collection outside of its own jurisdiction, even in another province. Antweiler says, quote, "There is a trade-off. While the economic rationale to tax all services, including online marketplace services provided to sellers, is sound, BC going this alone puts BC at a disadvantage." So even those who are in favor of the policy do note that it's going to put BC in a bit of a disadvantage, because our economy is not going to be quite as competitive as other places, because they won't have to be dealing with this tax. So BC going it alone is not a new thing, as Canada's westernmost province has often broken ground on innovative policies that the rest of Canada has followed on. Unfortunately, lately it seems that all of those innovative policies are taxes that instead take more money out of people's wallets and into the hands of the government instead.
And with this, you ask the question, of course, everything that you buy in a brick and mortar store is subject to the PST, if it's, of course, the certain class of good that the PST is subject to. And people who are proponents of putting the PST on online retailers will say, well, it's just exactly the same case as if you were to go out into a store. But what that conveniently ignores is that when you're looking at this in isolation, you have a situation where previously online retailers in BC were able to compete on an even ground with other provinces, whereas now they're going to have to throw that extra provincial sales tax in, which just is going to, in effect, reduce the amount of competition that they're able to have within all their goods. And at the end of the day, it's just another restriction on the corporations who are operating online and hit that marker of the $10,000 in sales because of that. And following from that, it's going to cause people to ask a lot of questions. If I'm going to set up a business in BC that's going to sell primarily online, maybe I might choose a different province instead. And that's the question that's going to be talked about at the end of the day with this. And it really should, at this point, go forward and raise even more questions when the BC NDP start their leadership race, because this is something that the new premier could have a different stance on than what this current government does.
Yes, and it could be something different than what we see going forward. But I don't think the BC NDP are going to have a candidate that argues against giving more money to the government, since we've seen them raise taxes stealthily in other ways as well that really didn't receive much coverage. And this particular story didn't receive a whole lot of coverage either, with only one major story in the Vancouver Sun about it, and not really much else. So I think that when it comes down to it, the BC media has been more focused on Horgan's impending retirement, as well as the bank shooting that happened in Victoria that's still making headlines as the shooters there just got their names released by the police this afternoon as of recording. So there's going to be more and more discussions about that, and stories like this that are going to impact people more are going to fly under the radar. And that's why we're here at Western Context, to talk about the stories that actually matter most and to really cover the stories that the media won't.
Yeah, and with that, I think we can move on into our word of the week, because what you just described here is potentially what happens sometimes to people, both on the left and right, and pretty much anybody can be a victim of this, depending on what media you consume.
Yes, and our word of the week is siloed, which means to be isolated from others, such as being put into their own individual storage units and not being able to converse with one another. And I think that being siloed is something that people have unintentionally have happened to them over the past couple of years, especially with the rise of social media, but also with the federal government that has been increasingly divisive, pitting regions of the country and classes of people against each other, and using a lot of identity politics to further their own agenda. So I think siloed is a perfectly good word of the week, because it kind of describes what's been going on in Canada, and definitely describes some of the discussion around Canada Day that seems to come up every year, especially in the last few years.
Yeah, and when you look at it, at the end of it all, there's lots of questions that come up about how much role the media has in this, and whether or not what they do is in effect helping or hurting more people. And the fact that the questions aren't answered on that is precisely why we do this each and every week here at Western Context, because nobody else is doing this, and that's precisely what this entire podcast is about. You can, of course, with that, find every story we talked about, including all the supplementals, in our full show notes at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe on any podcast listener out there. We're on Apple, Pocket Cast, Google, Spotify, and more. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we share the stories that we're looking at throughout the week and some other things as well. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
I'll be sure to look through all the stories of the week that are cropping up here and there. Whether or not the media describes them or goes over them, we will be here to talk about the news that really matters, and whether we find them in TV, radio, print, or online, we will find them, and we will give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.